Gentlemen, the show that's all about a little bit of unity out there. It's the Finney Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinneyEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GuerrillaMedia.co.nz. Egypt being a very, very big story, of course, over the last couple of weeks, is entering into interesting territory. Those of you who haven't heard already, Mubarak has stepped down and the military has stepped on up to the plate. Isn't that nice of them? Great, we got rid of a dictator. Now we have the military in control of their entire country. What a positive outcome. Well, that's just my cynicism working here. I mean, Will, what was it? The Muslim Brotherhood and all this kind of fear-mongering is starting up. But they were founded and funded and protected and helped to be run by the friggin' CIA in there in the Arab region to promote a little destabilizing effect so that everybody will be freaked out about radical Islam, so that they can introduce their police state measures here, wherever here may be.
Well, yeah, I mean, the CIA has been, you know, instrumental in the entire region since their founding, you know, and you know, especially since 1953 in Iran with Mohammad Mossadegh there. But, I mean, of course, it's a coup. The same people who are in control during Mubarak's time are still in control now, and so I guess it's a different face of them. Are they happy now?
Well, it says
300 people are dead. I mean, are they happy now?
No, they'll never be happy with just 300. It says in World Bank IMF documents that one of the things that they do after they get the country monstrously in debt and so that it's all in servitude and in poverty, like, then they stage revolutions so that it'll further devalue the country so that they can come in and buy up its assets for pennies on the dollar. So it's
that's
like
the thing.
One step, two step program.
And that's the thing. All the socialists and anarchists and so on types who are in support of that sort of action, you know, this revolutionary action supposedly, and are in support of the people. Do the people protesting really understand how the banking system, how the banking cartels work in this world? You know what I mean? Like how they enslave their country? Because if they did, perhaps they wouldn't have embarked on this whole effort to overthrow a single figurehead.
Well, yeah, and that's the difficulty dealing with these types of situations, is that you won't get any decent information from mainstream media. I mean, sure, they'll tell you about what's happening, but they won't tell you the how or the why to any great effect. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GuerrillaMedia.co.nz. Our very special guest coming up after the break is Christy Aphrodite from Truth Brigade Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on American Freedom Radio. Our very special guest joining us live is Christy from Truth Brigade Radio, and she's got some nice, terrible, harrowing stories to tell, I'm sure. Christy, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Gosh, this is just like deja vu.
Yeah.
I think I just did this.
Yeah, well, you know, this is the interesting thing. You're on quite a few radio shows today. In fact, you've been on James Burns, and you're on this show now, and then, of course, you got your own show just afterwards. So you're like in the whole media saturation effect. I hope you have some towels handy.
It's a busy day for sure, and I do have my portable potty with me.
Colossal.
But I'm glad someone will let me talk today, though. They weren't about to let me talk in the court.
Yeah. All right, right. Going hardcore, colostomy bag is locked in.
All right. That's pretty much what it feels like. Goodness. Yeah.
Yeah, speaking of colostomy bags, the judge... I'd like you to tell us a little bit because, you know, those of you who are unfamiliar with the story, Christy had her kids taken off her a while ago and she's just now getting into court and been given the runaround quite substantially by various scum. And I'd really love it if you kind of elaborate because I don't know about you, but I have some kind of sick, sadistic fashion when it comes to scum and I just love talking about them.
Yes, and you know what? I'm a glutton for punishment, so I guess that's why I keep butting heads with these guys. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's definitely been kind of up against a lot. They took my children over 10 months ago, and they did this solely based on a call from a neighbor, and a neighbor, mind you, the same ones that, I don't know if you've seen my albums on Facebook, but I had been documenting this for some time, like almost a year before the incident, breaking into places, vandalizing property, stealing things, even my children's things. They would break into houses and steal their money and $1,500 bikes and get in trouble and then try to blame it on my daughters, etc. So naturally, they were off limits. But I guess they weren't happy about that, and they kind of caused friction because we homeschool, and, you know, so our schedule's a little bit different. And if they don't get their hours in, guess what? They're doing it on the weekend. So it wasn't like regimented, like, okay, 8 to 5 or 8 to 3 like schools. If you want to sleep till 10 and do your work later, okay. If you want to take a 3-hour break and go play at the lake, fine, no problem. But... you know, they did have to get their hours in eventually. So it was a weekend, and my children, of course, were told by these people that reading on the weekend was child abuse. And April 12th, the day this happened, was, you know, a really lovely spring day. I think it was like 70 or 75, you know, just right after the winter. It was perfect. And, you know, my daughters are teens and preteens. They, you know, did not want to be inside reading. They wanted to be out playing with their friends. And anyways, so they kind of snuck out and played with the off-limit friends who made this report to CPS and the sheriff. Incidentally, the same county that they actually work for. But anyway, so based on this report from them and what I gathered in the family court, they call anonymous phone calls. They say the callers have to be protected, but what they did note was that they were out of state. So a report by the one neighbor and then out-of-state calls. So no questions asked. They didn't knock on my door and say, "Hi, Christy, did you do something bad?" Or, "We have to talk," or, "We want to investigate," or nothing like that. They just came to my door while I was live on the air and, you know, basically broke in my house, and you know, and they were already told because I went downstairs when from my house there's a little loft, and I'm looking right down at the door, and I had seen that they had already come in the gate and were trying to come in the screen door, and then I had the front door open. So it's spring, you know, the door's always open. When the break came, I went down there, and I'm like, "Hi, can I help you? We need to talk to you." "Okay, well, sure, I'd be happy to talk to you, but I'm on a show right now. I'll be right back." "Oh, no, you won't." And that's when he grabbed me and came in the house, kicked me down, beat my head up against the my cherry pyramid dresser. And anyways, they, of course, at the time didn't have a warrant, didn't have any charges. There were no crimes or kids with bruises or, you know, anything crazy like that. And in fact, when they were here, I still didn't even know why they were here. I wasn't even told until after I was put in the car and arrested. It was not only me, myself arrested, it was the two neighbors, because my children were screaming, "Help, help, help my mommy, they're hurting my mom." And so they come
this is comical, Christy, because, you know, isn't it just lovely how much your rights are protected under the Constitution in this day and age?
Yeah, and I supposedly abused these children, right? Yet they're screaming and begging for help and then running over to the police car and opening up the door and hugging me and kissing me and holding on and crying. Okay, so they were kidnapped. They were taken by force. They put me in jail. This is April 12th. And then April 13th is when they got the arrest warrant. Well, my. Due process would tell you that, you know, first thing, okay, you take a report. Okay, well, you need to substantiate it. And you do that by, investigation, not based on words, by perfect strangers from out of state. And then, you know, a neighbor that there's been an ongoing, you know, feud with. anyways, that's what they did, took my children, put me in jail, blah, blah, blah. Here we are, 10 months later. I'll go over a few of the key or significant points. June 4th was a hearing in the family or the juvenile court. And that's when the charges changed. That's when, and in fact, I never was even notified of the nature and cause of the charges because they haven't given me discovery. I filed a sunshine request and they sent me back a letter saying they're not available to me. My other neighbor who was able to get one, it was like 70% redacted. It was all blacked out. Well, in the family court, I find out that those reports that were all over the news that they were slandering me with because I supposedly locked out my children and tied them up in the woods. Well, Miss Emily Nichols, the so-called investigator who never did an investigation, said that she didn't write those reports. Okay, well, is your name Emily Nichols? Yes. Is this your name here? Yes. But I didn't write that. You didn't write that. Okay, well, who did? Well, I don't know. Okay, well, if you don't know who wrote it, why did you take my children? Oh, well, based on the report. Okay, what report? We can't tell you. It's anonymous because it's a juvenile case. Yeah. Okay, so I'm all right. After the one worker testified, there was no abuse or no neglect. And Emily Nichols testified that she did not write those reports. Not only that, she testified that she knew that they could not have taken place. Okay, so I get to ask her, well, okay, so did you perform an investigation? No. Did you talk to me when you came to my house? No. Well, why not? We were arresting you. Well, wait a minute. You said you weren't here to arrest me. So what? And they didn't have any legal or lawful authority to do so. So it was obviously a setup. Later, so it turns out. Oh, I know. It really is.
It's beyond crazy to the point where I'd even go so far as to call it totally and utterly retarded.
It really, well, you believe it or not, it gets worse.
Oh, no!
by all these things. And, you know, so I would ask him, okay, so you didn't investigate, you didn't talk to me, but you took my children anyways, right? So why'd you take my children? Well, based on the preponderance of evidence, okay, well, what is this evidence? Based on the allegations in the reports. Okay, well, that's not evidence. Those are allegations. So are you withholding evidence from me? And, you know, they all hated that question and they weren't, but they insisted that, allegations are evidence. And I actually had to ask the judge himself. It's like, well, wait a minute. Is anyone going to ever ask me, did I do this to my children? What are you saying that I really did do? And where is this evidence? And, oh, well, the evidence is their testimony. I said, okay, so you're telling me their words under oath qualifies as evidence. He said, yes. All right. Well, that's a little shady, but okay, fine. I'll play your game. Sounds great. Do I get to testify too? Well, they didn't know. Well, sure, but I didn't know. I didn't even know it was a court date, honestly. I just thought I was showing up for a review because that's the only information the worker gave me. But anyways, I ended up, I got to sit on the stand where people were supposed, the other eight lawyers that were there were supposed to question me, but they didn't have any questions for me. And I didn't know that I could speak for myself at the time, just, or ask myself questions just to get it on the record. But it is family court, so they don't follow typical court rules. There is no such thing as due process. It's shoot first, ask questions later, if you have enough money to pay to make someone ask the questions.
And, where do these people's training manuals come from? And do they put them all in a room and give them aspartame-flavored lollipops and just hope they get enlightened by osmosis? What the hell is going on here?
Yeah, well, I think it's probably like the Mao manual or something. I mean, it's they're obviously not following their own rules, and I keep attempting to bring that into light unsuccessfully.
Well, this is something that happens all the time, isn't it? You know, it's like the politicians, the lawmakers, you know, they make copious amounts of rules, but they don't follow one of them.
Yeah, exactly.
So the rules are for us, not for you. No, because you're just above reproach, you know. You've only got the power to send people away to jail for the rest of their natural life. We shouldn't have any checks and balances on that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, they really don't even care. And you walk in with a whole bunch of their own rules. It's their rules. I didn't write them. And they look at you like you're crazy, like you're making it up as you go along or something. But anyway, okay, so getting back to June 4th, the judge knew. They had already testified. There was no evidence. There was no abuse, neglect, etc. And in fact, it's on their own intake report that my children were in a healthy place, they were fine, no physical problems, psychological problems, etc. But the judge
clearly
was so frustrated.
Clearly, you know, in danger.
Well, yeah, I homeschool and we don't do their drugs and fluoride in vaccines. So, yeah, we are, I guess, a threat, a healthy threat for some crazy reason.
Hold on a second. You don't feed your kids medication? You don't pump viruses into your kids' bloodstream? Why? You're just a bad parent.
Well, exactly. See, my opinion and my belief, and this is my right as a parent, is that that is child abuse. Drugging your children is child abuse, okay? And that's my opinion. So, yeah, and I'm entitled to that. I don't care what anyone else thinks. But see, the whole thing that twisted into me first, tying him up and locking him out, then, oh no, whoops, she didn't do that, she locked him in. Oh no, wait, it wasn't about that. It was about Christy being anti-government and not taking their drugs and fluoride and teaching my children about vaccines and chemtrails equated medical neglect, and then homeschooling was equivalent to educational neglect. And Prosecutor Jeff Merrill of this county is pretty famous for prosecuting homeschooling students because he calls it compulsory school attendance, meaning this in this voluntary system, this public education, you must go or we take your children away and drug them up and make them go.
So this is the problem, though. I mean, you see where people who support the sort of government intervention stand. They say, well, look, there are alcoholic and drug abusing families out there. There are people with gambling addictions. There are people who beat their wives and children. We need to have a catch net that can accommodate for some of these children in poor family backgrounds. And so mm-hmm. people say, okay, we need to empower government with a certain structure to be able to have checks and balances on us in order to ensure, you know, there's no child left behind.
Yeah.
And but then it goes too far, doesn't it? It's the same with the police. You know, they have to have a certain amount of power to go after the bad guys, quote. But then they get too much power given to them, and there's still people calling for more. We need to give them more power as soon as some cop gets shot or something. That's just part of the job.
Well, the problem is they're the bad guys. They're the ones committing the crime, and their job is to silence people like us that aren't going to stay quiet about it.
But what do you think of all the leftists who say...
tough little girls like me exposing sex trafficking rings. I mean, Christy, stay out of their business. That's not your business. Don't interfere. Well, you know what? I'm sorry. When you see... Yeah, when I see little girls getting raped, you go save them. I'm sorry, that's the way things are in my world.
Don't you know the rules, Christy? You can't talk about child kidnapping and pedophile rings unless you're a child kidnapper or pedophile. I mean, that's just not how it's done.
Yeah, and you're not allowed to infiltrate a sex trafficking ring and make friends with the guys and get them on video and get all the information. And, you know, you're not allowed to videotape it all. Oh, you're not allowed to do that either.
It's just not being transparent.
I'm interested in what you think are good solutions here. I mean, what do you think is a good solution to, okay, there's lots of social problems out there. Most of them are created by the government, you know, getting people hooked on drugs and alcohol. Most of them created by the government. Okay, but we can't solve that overnight. So if we took our countries back, we're still going to have this problem with, you know, neglected parents. How are we going to ensure their children are safe?
Okay,
I say it's not with a government model. I say it's with a community model, but. What do you reckon?
Well, yeah, absolutely. But this is the problem. And Nancy Schaefer, of course, you know about her. She was murdered for exposing the system. But it's something like maybe 3% of the children that are actually taken from their homes are actually abused. And in fact, before they introduced the Safe Adoption Act or AFSA, I think it's called. Yeah, AFSA. There was like 3,000 child abuse reports nationally in the entire year. And then as soon as they introduced that new bill and started giving people federal funds and, you know, $4,000 bonuses and $2,000 a month for those on drugs, then all of a sudden there were over 3 million reports of child abuse. But here's the problem I see. The children that are abused, the children that are being raped or beat or, you know, maybe on like crack or their parents are or things like that, they're not taken. And I know because I know people in schools that are trying to get help for these girls, but I'll carry on when we return.
Yeah. It's a hilarious topic, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? You're listening to the Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. It's the lighter side of genocide, broadcasting live from the future. And we'll be right back after the break with our very special guest, Christy from Truth Brigade.
people wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, or the times they are a-changing.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. And I'd advise you, if you wanted to learn a little bit more than we're going to be able to talk about on this particular hour of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, go to GorillaMedia.co.nz. There are multiple articles posted up near the top of the feed for you to listen to, and you can also read those lower down on the homepage of the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. On that note, Christy, welcome back.
Thank you. And yeah, I guess we kind of ran out of time there, but getting back to the children who do need help, they're, you know, they don't want the abused children because they can't sell them. And what this basically is a trafficking business, a money funneling business. They employ psychologists, judges, lawyers, state employees, court investigators, counselors, foster parents, adoptive parents, caseworkers, social workers, foster parents. I mean, it's just never ending. The people that are getting paid, and you know, I guess they get $96,000 a year for every child they bring in. And you know, so bonuses when they come in, bonuses when they place them, bonuses when they adopt them out. And you know, the real interesting thing is the National Center on Child Abuse and Neglect in 1998 reported that six times as many children died in foster care than in the general public. And once removed to official so-called safety, these children are far more likely to suffer abuse, including sexual molestation. Okay, also suicide, and that list goes on and on. So
and the risk is substantially more as well. I think it was something like you're five times more likely to be abused.
Six times?
Six times now.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Wow. They're batting for new record averages, are they?
Well, and it's getting worse and worse, and these statistics are old. But, you know, Nancy, I mean, getting back to what they can do, Nancy Schaefer made a bunch of, you know, just simple recommendations right before she was murdered for exposing this criminal syndicate. But I'll just share with you some of the things that she asks. Call for an independent audit of the Department of Family and Children's Services. Okay, sounds fair enough, right? She asks for activate immediate change, because every day that passes means more families and children are subject to being held hostage. She asks to end the financial incentives that separate families. She asks for parents to have their rights given them to them in writing. She also suggests that they should mandate a search for family members to be given the opportunity to adopt to their own relatives, because many times, you know, there are willing relatives. You've had them on your show. I mean, that people, grandparents, exes, etc. But, you know, they just, for some reason, can't find them or aren't interested, or they're not good enough because they're getting paid more money to send them somewhere else. She also suggests that they mandate a jury trial. Wow, what a novel idea. You mean due process and be proven guilty instead of just accepted guilty on allegations? And then she suggests to require a warrant before they go in and they take someone's children. So, I mean, I don't know if they could ever do that, but really, if the system is supposed to work the way they say it does, I mean, according to the rules that they've already written, I just think they should follow them.
Yeah, well, you know, it's basically
that's
like
all.
If you're trying to understand the system, don't understand it from thinking, oh, the system's supposed to work. Think, understand it from the point where the system's not supposed to work and it's supposed to cause as much harm as humanly conceivably possible. And you'll probably be more likely to come up with an answer that is more fitting to the facts. And this
in terms of solutions, though, to this problem in a mainstream sense, because these mainstream zombies, you know, they're not going to believe, you know, at least within this lifetime, that the government's trafficking children. I mean, they just won't get it through their heads, will they? Because they see power.
Well, until it happens to them.
Until it happens to them, or even if it does happen to them, because, hey, they're drinking the fluoride and aspartame every day. They don't seem to mind that either. I mean, you know what I mean? So how, on a mainstream level, in terms of their limited level of understanding, do we move away from a government-controlled catch net nanny state system that supposedly supports abused children to a system that doesn't empower any sort of government level where this corruption can go on? How do we disempower their mechanism?
You know, that's a good question, and I would only suggest, and because the system, as they wrote it and designed it, certainly isn't working, well, yes, that's true, and yes, they do whatever they want, et cetera, blah, 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 I understand, but ultimately the ball is in our court, because we get scared, we fall for their fear and intimidation tactics, we let them get away with it, we don't appeal, we don't challenge them, like I tried to do in court today, and with my motion that they basically completely ignored, but I mean, just the fact that they're being challenged means that it is on the record, whereas most of this government abuse never goes on the record. And that's because, well, as you heard in the audio today, how he was pushing me, oh, you have to have a lawyer. This is serious. You have to have a lawyer. Well, first of all, no, I don't, number one. And number two, the lawyers work for the bar first, the court second, and for the client third. And no lawyer who works for them is going to challenge them on the legality of jurisdiction. You know, there is no jurisdiction in family court. They hold no authority other than they're operating under color of law. So the authority they have, I mean, yeah, they have guns. Yeah, they have jail cells. So they're doing it anyways. But if people instead of say, oh, okay, you win, sure, fine, allegations are evidence, have fun with my children, you know, have a good life, we got to stop doing that.
They basically have the same amount of authority as a, as a Colombian kidnapping syndicate.
or a taxi cab driver.
I mean,
really, they don't, they're doing it because we're letting them. Well, and how do we stop them? We can't physically stop them, obviously. We can't, you know, we have to do what we can do. And even if it is just questioning them and getting it in a record in the court and trying to get it out in the media so people are aware, I mean, maybe there's a possibility of these same baby snatchers not being voted in again, because CPS is not acting alone. But what's happened is that they have literally gained authority over the police and sheriffs. In fact, we've had ex-cops on the show that talk about, you know, CPS. I mean, all they have to do is call the sheriff and say, go to this house because we have a report that, you know, this person's sticking gerbils up their butt. Or whatever, however outrageous it is, and they send the badges and guns to get it. But I think we need to bring to the surface the unconstitutionality, the illegality, the unlawfulness of the family court system, the child protective services, because children are not being protected. And if they really were about protecting the children, I mean, I'd like to ask them this. How come it's these very same people that didn't care when their mom was in a wheelchair? They didn't care when we were getting burned. They didn't care that people were threatening to kill us or following us around. They didn't care. But all of a sudden, one of these people or anyone, I mean, that's the thing, Vinny, I could have a beef with you and just call and say, oh, he's doing this with his daughter, and you don't even have the right to answer those questions. I have never, to this day, 10 months and 2 days later, I still have not been able to answer to the questions. Have you abused your children? Did you tie them up? Did you lock them out? Are you really anti? I mean, none of these questions at all. And it's almost a year and they're gone.
Yeah. No, it's just wrong. It's simply wrong. And I'm sick of these idiot thug, bother boy, police freaks just allowing themselves to be thrown around like the cheap thugs they are, you know? Like, I'm sick of their unthinkingness on their behalf. Just like a little hit squad mafia team goes around and rough people up and you know, ask for protection money. Yeah. I mean, that's how they act.
That's exactly what I was going to say. That's exactly textbook mafioso 101, you know?
Yes. Well, you know, speaking of the mafia, the ADL is training our law enforcement, and we've done those shows, and we can go in and how, you know, that's a mob. That is certainly a mob, and the government is a mob, but I think that's really interesting that they are using the same type of tactics that we're supposed to be protected from.
Yeah, it reminds me of the little plaque that's on Congressman Ron Paul's desk. It says, "No stealing. The government doesn't like competition."
Yeah, exactly. I think I have a sticker on my car that says, "The difference between mafia and government? Size."
But then that just begs the question, where does the mafia end and the government begin? Or did the government just begin the mafia?
Exactly. I mean, they're
Giuseppe Mazzini was
interchangeable.
Giuseppe Mazzini was a high-level mason, too. So, yeah.
Oh, what a surprise.
Well, you know what's funny? I mean, I guess when you get into the court system, they pretty much all are. And, you know, they're in the club and we're not in it. And they just expect us to just bow down and not do anything. But I'm just suggesting that we need to stand up. And I know it's scary and I know it's hard. And thankfully, you know, I have a few really, really good friends who've been here to support me or give me a shoulder to cry on or to help me try to file these motions in some language I've never heard of, you know, because I'm not a court expert. I mean, I don't know anything about it, really. So what little I know, I've had to learn just in this short time.
Yeah.
But I tried to avoid it.
It's all just basically lawful bowel movements. You know, that's what's going on here in the courts.
Oh, I love bowel movements.
They're just passing this legal dysentery through the entire consciousness of man, trying to convince people that it actually means something and it smells good. When in actual fact, it doesn't mean crap because that's what it is, and it smells awful.
I mean, the fact you haven't been able to even, you know, answer your own accusations laid upon you is just so indicative of the system. I mean, I wouldn't have a problem with all them and all their little weird groups and rituals if they actually were truthful, virtuous individuals who did believe in some sort of honor and chivalry and, you know what I mean? If they actually believed and practiced what they supposedly preached to each other, then I wouldn't have a problem with them.
But well, you know what? They'll wake up when it happens to them. One of these days, they're going to cross someone and the same thing's going to happen to them and they're going
to
be like,
to those
oh,
judges.
Wow. Oh, well, of
judges.
Course not.
Yeah. And
but you know what does happen?
One element that I wanted to explore here was violent opposition, because I was thinking about this the other day, that this system's so criminal, especially with taking people's kids, and some parents would just get absolutely wild, pick up a gun and start shooting at the people who come through their door.
I think they should.
What would happen there is that homeschoolers, and just from a propaganda perspective, of course, homeschoolers and anybody who would protect their children automatically would then get demonized throughout the media, just like this Jared Lee Loeffner or whatever being demonized as a Republican or whatever the heck, you know. And it would serve as a great psyop. And I think that that's exactly what the establishment needs, is people to start shooting their people.
They do. Okay, look at this. Anybody else walks on your property and tries to kidnap your children, you shoot them, you're justified. Hello, castle law. I mean, that's part of living in America,
not
Second
New Zealand.
Amendment. You have the, okay, oh, really? Okay. You have castle law?
Well, over here, a farmer had a couple of rough ones break onto his property trying to steal his quad bike, and so he shot at one of them. I don't think he even killed the guy. It's a few years back now. He shot at him, and he ends up going to prison, like, in sentence for 8 years.
Of course.
Yeah,
like,
that's
you
right.
Defend yourself here.
That happens here, too.
You've got to call the authorities and wait a few hours and...
See, and this
well,
is the
that's
thing.
Why we so don't imagine, call and the that's, authorities.
Yeah, but that's but Christy, that's when we shoot somebody who actually is a criminal, actually there mm-hmm. with the specific purpose of committing a crime. If somebody comes on your property under the pretense of being law enforcement in order to protect children, and if you shoot them, regardless of how illegal their activities, no matter how horrendous and horrible they are, you will go down for a very long time. And in this country, yeah. nobody has ever lived a long life after killing a police officer. You're listening mm-hmm. to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, the lighter side of genocide. We'll be right back.
La donna è mobile, qual più al vento, sola cieco e di pensiero, sempre una mobile, leggiadro di...
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Broadcasting live from the future, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GuerrillaMedia.co.nz. And we welcome back our very special guest, cop killer Christy. Christy, welcome back.
Wow, my reputation precedes me. You know what's funny about that, though, is the reason the cop said that he felt that he had to come into my house like that and beat me up was because he heard that I could have a gun or could potentially be dangerous. And so then I want to ask, well, if that's true, then why did you do that alone with a girl, you know, a social worker? That doesn't make sense. But, you know, we were talking on the break, and I tell you, you know, look, there's no difference between these people acting under color of law, walking onto your property to steal your children without due process, without a warrant, without indictments, than me walking on your property to steal your children. There's no difference. And, you know, we have laws to protect us from that. I mean, of course, it's not working. The laws are, you know, I guess they kind of forgot about those in the law, but maybe they forgot about them because we're not reminding them.
Yeah, I don't know. And a high-powered rifle can often be one hell of a reminder. With the Ruby Ridge incident, and just remember, folks, I'm not advocating violence or anything like that. But Christy does, so it's all good.
Yes, I'm so violent and scary. I read that once or twice, but, you know, it's so silly. That's just something they use to justify their unlawful abuse, you know, on innocent people, innocent citizens daily. But you know what? It's almost, how many more millions of children are they going to steal before they walk on the wrong property? And, you know, like I said before, I'm in the backwoods, okay? And we're talking straight up deliverance. So, you know, one of these days, they're going to end up on one of those properties, and I don't think anyone's getting out alive. So if it really is for the children, why don't we protect the children? Why are we getting paid to destroy families? You're supposed to be reuniting the families. And, you know, maybe there's a situation, okay, like mine, when I was in a wheelchair and my children were feeding and clothing me. If you really cared about the children, why don't you, you know, come over and feed us a couple times a week, or, you know, take the children to their tutoring, or you know, help out if it really is for the children. But it's obviously not for the children. It's, you know, just another business. We're just commodities. We're meat. We're cattle. We're numbers. We're revenue. And that's all we are to them. That's all we are to the court system, unfortunately. But, you know, I do have hope, and I don't want to sound naive, and But I understand I'm not getting anywhere here as it is now, and I may not get anywhere in my next motion or the one after that, but I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to get discouraged, and I'll go to the top. I'll go to the next court. I'll go to the one above that, and whoever they are, I'll find out who they are. But we can't give up, and I know, you know, if you're a parent that's gone through this, I know how hard it is and how easy it is to want to give up, just to think. I mean, for me, I'll just tell you, that was my whole life. My entire identity was a mother. It was the only Christy I knew. It was the only reason for living. So, you know, it's very easy, I think, to, you know, question, why am I even here? And you know what? I think getting to that point is a good thing, because when you get there, you get angry and you realize, well, you know what? I lost everything anyways. So what other choice do I have? Fight. Now is not the time to bend over and lick your boots. Hi, sir. May I please have some soup? You know, whatever you want me to do. No, now is not the time to back down and just, you know, keep the pressure on in whatever small ways you can, and, you know, get connected with people, trustworthy people, friends or family or whoever you have, and, you know, allow them to lift you up in those dark days. And, you know, I'm not anywhere close to the end, so I can't tell you that definitively it's going to be a positive outcome, but I do know that I'm here for a reason. And I do, without sounding naive, I do feel that something good, maybe more than one thing, some things even, good will come out of this eventually. And one day we'll look back and say, oh, now I get it. And if it's because I'm the one to force the family court to start using due process, or at least bring it into the public eye so the voters and, you know, people are aware that this is happening, so be it.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good point as well, is because we have so many people that are getting shafted by the system, having their kids taken off them. It's essentially the worst plateau of criminality that's currently going on in our society. And anybody who knows anything about pedophilia, child kidnapping, or anything along those lines knows the true, pure, full spectrum evil that's involved with these groups, because they just love it, you know, for some reason or another. And those people like yourself, Christy, who choose not to remain silent, which is the majority group right there, the people who don't say anything and just allow themselves to be suppressed and don't do anything. And then on the other full side of the spectrum, we have the Ruby Ridge type phenomenon, where eventually, and I think you might be right, Christy, eventually somebody is going to be having their kids taken off them who is very well armed, well trained, and they won't be a single cop that will leave alive.
I don't think it's by chance, Vinny, that hasn't happened for a while. There's millions of guns in America, and I mean, I think they're just, they know not to go to certain listeners of the show's houses, perhaps.
It's called profiling. Thanks, Christy, for coming on.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's been fun.
All right. I'm glad you can have fun while your children are being kidnapped. Coming up next hour, we are going to be getting into a little bit more news. And hopefully we may have a Kiwi guest for you, ladies and gentlemen, who's talking about the amount of assets in New Zealand being privatized and taken offshore so that we all get left destitute slaves in the streets that our forefathers frickin' built with their own hands, sweat, blood, and tears. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Hour number two coming up next. The virus, alert the masses. For all, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you proudly by GorillaMedia.co.nz, New Zealand's unconventional news. Now, speaking of New Zealand and being rather unconventional, we have a very special guest for you, ladies and gentlemen, joining us from Kafka in Christchurch. His name is Murray Horton. And those of you in the world who are currently under free trade partnerships, which basically enslave your country quicker than anybody could ever conceive of, you'll probably understand what he's talking about. Murray, welcome to the program.
How are you, Vinny? Thank you for having me on.
Oh, mate, it's an absolute pleasure because, well, basically the difficulty is, Murray, where all of our nations are getting sold out pretty well and incrementally by our own governments and all doing these little crazy treaty heirs type thingies. But we'll get into that after this first short segment. I was more interested in you yourself, Murray, and how you got involved with Kafka and what it actually is, for that matter.
Okay, well, Kafka, C-A-F-C-A, stands for Campaign Against Foreign Control of Aotearoa. Now, you're broadcasting to an American audience, is that right, Vinny?
An American, New Zealand and Norwegian, not to mention about 88 different countries around the world.
Who don't recognise the last name, Aotearoa. Aotearoa is the indigenous Maori name for New Zealand, and it means land of the long white cloud. Although I'm pleased to say today, certainly at this end of the country, it's the land of the clear blue sky and lovely sunshine. So that's the name of our organisation, Kafka, not to be confused with Franz Kafka, the author. And we've been going for between 35 and 40 years now. I personally date back to the protest movement against things like the Vietnam War, etc., at the end of the 1960s and into the 70s. Kafka as an organisation grew out of that milieu.
Okay. And, well, how exactly, when was our first free trade deal? I mean, I know that the World Trade Organization has been working rather well at getting countries to buy into these things, and then they basically subsequently get all their assets either shut down or offshored to the detriment of the people who still live in the country. But what's the real source of this? I mean, what pressure is being put on governments in order to implement these basically nation-destroying policies?
The one that I know that goes back the furthest in New Zealand is CER, Closer Economic Relations with Australia, which actually goes back to 1983. And CER is sort of part of the wallpaper and the relationship between New Zealand and Australia, and it's regularly sort of, what's the word, liberalised and updated, etc. With a few exceptions, it establishes a common market between New Zealand and Australia. And as recently as, in fact, I think right now, the Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard is visiting New Zealand today. And I think they are signing an investment agreement between the two countries, which means that Australian firms investing in New Zealand, which are they're the biggest single source of foreign investment in New Zealand, not surprisingly, seeing their closest neighbour, get a much more privileged position than firms from other countries. Just to explain briefly the law.
We'll get into the explanation just after the break. Our very special guest, ladies and gentlemen, Murray Horton, coming at us from Kafka in Christchurch, New Zealand, the Campaign Against Foreign Control of Aotearoa, the land of the long white cloud, where we broadcast from live every day. And we'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Yeah. Yeah. And no one like me. Yeah. 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 Congratulations. You made it. Welcome to the Crusader. It's been a long time coming, yo.
Yeah.
But I'm here now. So what you wanna do?
Huh?
How many dudes you really know can flow like this, like this, like this? Let's do it. How many dudes you know vote like this? How many dudes you know flow like this?
Not many, if any, not many, if any.
How many dudes you know got the skills to go and rock a show like this? I don't know anybody.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally, TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. We're broadcasting live from the future on Rush 89 FM in Hamilton. The Tron, the city of the future, the city of Agenda 21. Welcome back. Also to our very, very special guest who I'm delighted to bring on with us for a whole hour today, Murray Horton from CAFCA, the Campaign Against Foreign Ownership of New Zealand. Murray, welcome back.
Vinnie, what we were saying before the break was you asked when do these free trade agreements date back to. I suppose they got serious in the 80s and into the 90s. There was an organization, you're familiar with the World Trade Organization, the WTO. The predecessor of that was called GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And there was a thing called the Uruguay Round, which was the name of a round of negotiations on agriculture, and that went through and was concluded in the 1990s, 94, 95 from memory. GATT was replaced by the WTO, and they launched a series of negotiations trying to get a sort of overarching free trade agreement to sort of bind the sort of the world together into these sort of agreements in the interests of big business. And it's worth noting, of course, that these free trade agreements also always carry with them embedded investment agreements. And so probably this thing reached its pinnacle around about the turn of the century when we had New Zealand and Christchurch's very own Mike Moore, not to be confused with Michael Moore, the filmmaker. Mike Moore was, of course, for a while there, a few years, the Director General of the World Trade Organization. Right now, he is the New Zealand Ambassador to the United States. So the WTO, but it got bogged down. It's trying to resolve a thing called the Doha Round, named after the capital of Qatar in the Middle East, and what they can't agree on is agriculture, among other things. So the WTO is bogged down, so what's happened is the governments of the world have tried to go for a series of what are called bilateral, two countries, or multilateral, several country trade agreements. A bilateral agreement, an example, is what I was talking about before the break.
So the shorthand is they couldn't scam the whole world at one time, so they decided
they
to scam
do it
individually.
In one hit. They tried in the 90s with a thing called the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, or the MAI, which was an attempt to actually establish a binding investment, not trade, investment treaty that would give corporations the right to sue and would give corporations the same legal standing as governments. They tried to do that, and that was the subject of a very major campaign, both here in New Zealand and also internationally, and it was defeated both here in New Zealand and internationally. That was an attempt to do a sort of one king hit to establish sort of global corporate rule, and it failed. And so what's happening now, the New Zealand government and the other countries around the world have been going for something a little less grandiose. In America, for example, they have NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, which is the US, Canada and Mexico, and has some salutary lessons for New Zealand on that. Most countries have been going for these, as I say, bilateral or multilateral with a number of other countries, trade agreements. And the one that we're concerned about, our organization concerned about right now, is what's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. And this is an attempt to, it's being negotiated right now. I mean, literally this week, there is a round of negotiations taking place in Chile. This involves New Zealand, the United States, and seven other countries, total of nine. Trying to sort of sign a trade agreement, which would include an investment agreement.
Let's hope some emails get leaked about that, and they'll call them the Ninth Gate emails.
Well, something like that. Yes, exactly. If that the timetable of the negotiators is to have it signed in Obama's home state of Hawaii, I think it's November this year, 2011, when the United States hosts the annual summit of APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, it's called. I'm sure your listeners have heard of APEC, and the idea is to have this treaty ready to be signed then. What's happened, I mean, the history of this very briefly, there was a thing called the P4. P stood for Pacific. Pacific 4, existing treaty between, a rather obscure one, between New Zealand, Chile, Brunei, and Singapore, rather unlikely group. But anyway, there was an existing free trade agreement between those four countries. And then, under the previous Labor government here in 08, it was announced in the final months of that government that that would be expanded to include the United States. And the effect of that would be to actually bring about a free trade agreement between New Zealand and the United States. It's sort of done by the back door. Both major political parties in this country, both National and Labor.
What a free trade deal actually is. I mean, my understanding is it's more or less an economic Trojan horse, basically, where foreign corporations suddenly get the rights of a human being, and then they can actually come in, operate business, and do it in a very corrupt and terrible way. And if the government of the day decides to say, hey, look, you guys are operating really, really unfairly in our country, we're going to kick you out, or we're going to stop you from trading, or we're going to do or take any number of measures through the courts, through to legislation or whatever, basically they're immune from any type of justice.
I mean, the free trade agreement with an embedded investment clause or embedded investment agreement basically gives corporations from that originating from that country that signs a treaty sort of special rights in the country. And so if there's a free trade agreement with the United States via this TPPPA, Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, that means that American corporations get a protected position here, and they would also have the right to take legal action against the New Zealand government if they feel that they've been discriminated against. John Key initially denied this, and the New Zealand Prime Minister initially denied that this would be in fact the case, but very recently, within the last week or so, one of the American negotiators has in fact put the position straight that New Zealand does accept, the New Zealand government does accept that American corporations and corporations from the other countries signing that treaty would have the right to take legal action and would have legal standing to do so.
Well, I guess we could just add that to the list of stuff that John Key said that hasn't panned out.
Exactly. I mean, if this treaty goes ahead, we can expect a further attack on what's left of foreign investment protections in this country. There aren't many. The United States has made very clear, for example, that it sees the existence of PharmAC, the government body in this country that regulates and sets the price that New Zealanders pay for prescription drugs. The U.S. sees PharmAC as being an impediment to the business of U.S. Drug companies and wants it gone. So therefore, they want to impose the American prescription drug model on New Zealand. And your American listeners won't need to be told what that means. That's why Americans cross Canada, the Canadian border in droves to get cheap drugs over the border in Canada. It has implications for things like intellectual property rights. It has implications for things like
New Zealand's law and not suicide and have many other disorders that are worse than whatever condition they were taking the drugs to help with.
Well, something like that, exactly. The U.S. makes very clear that its position is one of, the U.S. government makes clear that its position is one of pushing at all times very aggressively the interests of American big business. And this was made plain in the some of the cables, the diplomatic cables that were leaked by WikiLeaks late in 2010 and earlier this year, most of them related to military and intelligence aspects of the relationship with New Zealand, but some of them did directly relate to this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and what the United States sees as quote-unquote impediments to its the ability of its corporations, its transnational corporations, to do business in this country. So, the last Labor government signed up a free trade agreement with China in 2008, and that has already led to an upsurge of Chinese corporations coming into this country, Chinese agribusiness in particular, buying up New Zealand farms, New Zealand agribusinesses, etc., and there's been a whole backlash in public opinion and indeed within the ruling party in this country on this very subject. And when you'd be aware, your listeners will be aware, there was the attempt by a Chinese corporation to buy the bankrupt empire of the Crafer Farms, dairy farms in this country, and the Federated Farmers, which is the organisation of farmers in New Zealand, put out a press release saying this was an unintended consequence of the free trade agreement with China. Well, in actual fact, there's nothing unintended about that consequence at all. This is the way that free trade agreements operate. They provide a platform for corporations, businesses, firms, etc., from the country signing the treaty to sort of come in and operate with all legal protections and, in fact, have a privileged position. So we can, we've already seen a sort of a push by sort of Chinese money into New Zealand.
Would it then be accurate to say that free trade deals are anti-competitive?
They are. I always put the word free and free trade in inverted commas because there's nothing free about it at all. It's actually preserving a monopoly position of sort of large corporations. And we've seen very, very recently in this country the way American big business operates when it wants things to get its own way. And the perfect example of that was the behavior of Warner Brothers when they came flying in, sent their executives over here, and whenever it was, October 2010, to sort of heavy New Zealand Actors Union and indeed the New Zealand government, headed by the very same Mr. Key, to give Warner Brothers everything they wanted in relation to continuing to film Peter Jackson's film The Hobbit in New Zealand. They wanted labour laws changed in this country, which the government obligingly did, and they wanted more of a taxpayer subsidy, more money, which also the government obligingly did. I think it's somewhere up around 100 million New Zealand dollars now that is being paid out by the New Zealand government so that Warner Brothers will continue to grace us with their presence, and The Hobbit will be filmed in New Zealand as opposed to being filmed in Romania, which is what the option was, the alternative that was being presented. So that's a perfect illustration of the way American big business operates. There's no pretense of it being a free market or anything like that. In the case of Warner Brothers, they came in and received what in the States is called corporate welfare. They, in fact, are among the biggest bludgers or parasites, welfare parasites, in this country in terms of getting taxpayer money. And they demanded that the laws of New Zealand be changed, the labour laws, to suit their one and particular project. So that is a warning.
What are your thoughts, Murray, on the PACER agreement? Are you aware of the PACER agreement in the Pacific here?
I don't know the details. Yes, there's PICTA and PACER. I can't remember. There's two acronyms there.
The Pacific Agreement on Closer Economic Relations, it's the sort of our equivalent of the EU, a model being proposed to strengthen, quote, strengthen trade relations between Pacific nations.
Well, effectively, what the bigger economies, like the US, etc., are doing to us, we sort of, you know, we're the one step down. We're doing the same sort of thing to the smaller economies in our backyard. And so this has been the model, unfortunately, not only in trade matters, but in things like military matters. The previous Australian Prime Minister, John Howard, revelled in the title of being George Bush's deputy sheriff in the South Pacific, and Helen Clark was therefore the sort of the deputy sheriff in terms of New Zealand's intervention in the affairs, internal affairs of not one but several Pacific countries. And so PICTA and PACER and those sort of agreements are sort of a fairly heavy-handed attempt by Australia and New Zealand to sort of force these smaller Pacific countries, smaller economies, into sort of throwing themselves open to New Zealand and Australian businesses. In other words, doing to them what the Americans and the larger countries are doing to us.
Yeah. Well, speaking of what the Americans are doing to us and all of that kind of thing, I think this goes beyond nations here, there's a global plan here by these enormous organizations like World Bank, IMF, WTO to implement some description of global economic control grid, more or less, to make sure that sovereign nations basically no longer exist, and if they do exist, it's been so undermined that they wouldn't be able to resist if they tried. And the free trade deals, that's what my opinion is. They're basically just globalist dreams about how you can take out a country's ability to support itself. I mean, in New Zealand, we're an agricultural country, right? We produce more food than we can eat. And yet, our food prices are skyrocketing ridiculously. And recently, a free store has opened up, and it was cleared out within a few hours because there's that many people in this country who can't even afford their food. And this is exactly what the globalists want.
I mean, if you ask what is the motivation for the New Zealand government to push for these free trade agreements, the answer in one word is Fonterra. New Zealand government is basically sort of enamoured of opening the world market up for Fonterra's sort of dairy products, and that is always presented as the sort of the holy grail, opening up the American market in terms of a free trade agreement. But yeah, just as recently as the weekend, I was reading an article on the paper here about how if Fonterra, for example, gets higher dairy prices, that means that we, for its products overseas, that they put up the prices in New Zealand. There is absolutely no allowance made for the fact that this stuff originates in New Zealand, that New Zealanders have to pay the global market. So really what we should be, the global price, I'm sorry. So what we should really be hoping for is a sort of a crash in sort of what the price in Fonterra gets for its milk and butter and products overseas, because that's the only way that they will put the prices down in this country.
In other words, you're advocating for a war on Fonterrorism.
War on, yes. Well, I've seen Fonterra referred to as spelt in the end with T-E-R-R-O-R rather than the way it is actually spelt. And I mean, yeah, New Zealand, I mean, it's like the Americans used to say years ago that what was good for General Motors is good for America. I mean, it seems to be the line of both Labor and National governments in this country is what's good for Fonterra is good for New Zealand, which is definitely not necessarily the case at all. In terms of those organisations you mentioned, World Bank, WTO, etc., establishing some sort of corporate blueprint, the answer is yes, to a certain degree. They would want to see sort of the sovereign state undermined and replaced by sort of stateless, accountable to nobody but their own boards of directors corporations. I mentioned before APEC. It's significant that APEC is called the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. It is not actually an agreement between governments as they see it. It's an organization of economies, which is a complete nonsense. There is no such thing as an economy outside of the structure of a state or a government or a society. But that is the sort of way that these things date back to the sort of the 70s and the 80s, the sort of the boom years of sort of Thatcherism, Reaganism, and through the 90s into that sort of capitalist triumphalism that followed the sort of collapse of sort of the so-called collapse of communism. So this was sort of things like APEC, WTO, the extreme policies of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, etc., all sort of and mirrored in this country by the sort of the extreme ideological position of people within the New Zealand Treasury still to this day, all date back to that period of saying that basically we need less state. State is bad, public ownership is bad, what we need is businesses and big business running societies and preferably everything in private ownership as opposed to sort of public ownership. So,
yeah, and my question to
beyond,
the public, so...
You're right, there is an all-out assault on sovereignty and as part and parcel of that, an all-out assault on democracy. One of the most important factors of this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is that, like all free trade agreements, it's been negotiated in secret. I can't tell you what's been negotiated, what's in the text, because that's not actually been made public. And our elected representatives in Parliament won't get any chance to discuss it, let alone vote on it, until after.
Until after the fact. Oh, don't you just love foreign dictatorship, New Zealand? Don't you just love it? How's that working out for you? You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We'll be right back.
There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
That's precisely what it is. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about a little bit of history repeating. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, broadcasting live from the future, from the sunny slave capital in Auckland, New Zealand, on the very front lines of our fabulous New Zealand dictatorship we call a government. Our very special guest joining us live from Christchurch is Murray Horton from the Campaign Against Foreign Control of our fabulous country, Aotearoa. Welcome back, Murray.
Welcome back, Vinny.
Hey, well, one thing we wanted to get into, because the free trade deals are sort of like the wedge that gets driven into our countries to allow it to be kind of split apart and then facilitate more foreign control, foreign power in our country, which undermines our sovereignty. This I know, but the other side of it is more of a more of news of recent days is the privatization of state assets. What's your take on John Key's recent move?
Oh, entirely predictable. I mean, and national sort of knee-jerk reaction is always to try to sell off the national parties, to sell off sort of state. They subscribe to the view that state ownership is bad and private ownership is good, particularly that owned by their own mates. Key and National, when they were elected in 2008, promised that there wouldn't be any asset sales in their first term of government, which of course expires this year on November the 26th. Key has announced the election date. But now they've sort of put their cards on the table by saying that if re-elected, they will sell off, what is it, 49% of four electricity companies, generating companies, Solid Energy, the coal company, and Air New Zealand, the national airline. So, I mean, our view on that, Kafka, Campaign Against Foreign Control's view on that, is that they're bad moves. I used to work for the railways. So I actually spent 14 and a half years working for the railways, and that was the classic example of privatisation gone horribly wrong. I was actually gone when it was privatised in 1993. I was made redundant in 91. But the New Zealand taxpayer had to pick up the tab in 2008 and buy back the railway system of this country after it had been through not one but two sets of foreign owners, firstly Americans and secondly Australians. And
Hold on a second. You're saying that that's what happens when the privatisation goes wrong. Does that imply that any privatisation has ever gone right?
Well, the proponents of privatisation would say, yes, of course, it's a good thing. They would point out to various examples and that, but, I mean, from our point of view, the privatisations, you and I are talking on the phone here, Vinny, telecom is the perfect illustration of a privatisation that was the complete definitive rip-off in New Zealand. It was privatised, sold off totally in 1990 by Labor government, I think for $4.25 billion within less than 6 years. Its first lot of American owners had actually skimmed off somewhere between $5 and $10 billion in profits that had been shipped overseas. It was essentially a cash cow, and telecom service deteriorated. There was no motivation whatsoever for them to actually spend money on upgrading their system, etc. The last Labor government actually put pressure on telecom that if they didn't actually improve their service and their systems, etc., then Labor, the government, would step in and invoke various things and get it done. And so telecom very reluctantly actually started to sort of get their act together. But I mean, they were an example. They were just the company that was sold off, a monopoly position, the national phone company, sold off and turned into a cash cow for initially big American corporations, and still substantially an American. The ownership's been diluted, but the ownership is still essentially American shareholders. So that is probably still the biggest example of a privatisation that should never have taken place.
I agree with you there, because in the World Bank documents that were released, it talked about selling big state assets like telecommunications, essentially infrastructure-type assets, and selling it to companies that they themselves are heavily affiliated with. In telecom's case, this was a large American communications company called Bell Atlantic. And then, of course, you know, like you say, they just basically skim it all off the top and then sell it off to smaller investors to basically be left holding the bag.
Well, I mean, in relation to these announced privatisations that Key has said, he's stressed that, you know, the four power companies, the coal company and the airline, he has said that they will be, ownership will be aimed at, quote-unquote, mum and dad New Zealand investors. And that sounds fine in theory, but in actual fact, what happens, and this is not just my theory, this is based on previous precedents, what happens is those mum and dad investors either, A, don't want to get into buying shares or can't afford to. A lot of New Zealanders got burnt with the crash of the share market here in 1987. It was one of the stock markets that fell heaviest in the world, and it's never really recovered, actually, to the levels it got in the 1980s. So there's two things. Either mum and dad won't get involved in buying shares at all, or two, they will buy those shares, and then somebody will come along and say, here we are from sort of X corporation from the US or Germany or Australia or wherever, and we'll make you an offer of sort of that you can't refuse, and boom, those shares will be gone, and before you can say sort of, told you so, those corporations, the power companies, the coal company in New Zealand will be in the hands of foreign big business. And the government doesn't deny that. There's, I mean, that's how the market works. And they're all in favour of markets. So if mum and dad decide to sell out to sort of the first big corporation that comes along and offers to buy their shares, they'll be gone. When power companies in Auckland were sold off to sort of mum and dad investors, when they were issued shares back in the 90s, big institutional buyers sort of swooped on them fairly quickly and made them an offer they couldn't sort of refuse. And so those mum and dad investors were very swiftly bought out under the when there was a previous round of these privatisations of lines companies and power retailers in the 90s. So privatisation, I mean, effectively what it means is you get a privatisation of profit and a socialisation of losses, which means that you and I, the long-suffering taxpayer, are left to sort of clean up the mess, pick up the pieces, sort things out. Now, this happened with Air New Zealand. Air New Zealand was privatised in the 80s, the sort of the height of sort of Rogernomics in this country, and by 2001 it was basically bankrupt, and the government had to step in, the previous government, Labor government, and buy it back using our money. So, and as I say, that also happened with the railways, or Transrail, as it became. So there's two examples.
If that's the case, Murray, I mean, my assumption is, and I base my life on a lot of assumptions like most of the rest of the public, that the case is now open and shut. Public is much better than private, and we shouldn't be doing any of this at all, unless, of course, we really did want to undermine the country and undermine all its people. But the sheer logic of that statement will be lost on a lot of National Party cultists, because they'll go, all right, where did you do your shopping? And I say, well, I do my shopping at Pack and Save because it's slightly cheaper, and they sell me the same poison food as the rest of the supermarket chains with a slightly better price tag, and they call that competition, and then it's somehow a version of success for the bollocks that they rant about.
The thing that gets me about the public versus private debate, and you've got sort of the left on one side, you know, and the conservatives on one side and the other side supposedly, and you've got this big fake debate that goes on. The thing that gets me is our money isn't public, okay? Our cash is issued from foreign debtors,
right?
And so how is it that anything can be state owned?
How can anything be state owned?
That's what I want to know. Technically, how can anything be state owned? When our currency system isn't based in the state?
Well, that's a good theoretical question. I mean, there's always been a role in any country in the world, and certainly in the United States, bar none, there's been a role for public ownership of various functions that are deemed to be in the national interest and in the public good, that those functions should be actually held by the state. Even the sort of most right-wing so-called libertarian parties in this country say that there should be a role of the state in things like defence and law and order and justice and things like that.
But they miss the facts. They miss the point, though. Just like you said, these institutions, they privatise profits and socialise losses.
Or that's right.
No more so than the Federal Reserve Bank of America, which actually is privately owned.
Right.
By a handful of banks, about approximately eight banks, and their private shareholders, they issue the U.S. currency out of an incurred debt to the U.S. government,
right?
Because they're not a branch of government, and in the same way, we borrow money, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars off the Japanese, off European central banks every year in this country. We don't mint our own currency. And so even if something was, quote, a state-owned asset, is owned with effectively liquidity owed to someone else.
Well, that's,
so
that's
it's a false, it's a false paradigm. It's not even theoretical.
And, the question of debt is one that's being used as the excuse by Key for the need to partly privatise these assets that he's identified. And it is a straw man argument, because in actual fact, the debt that he's talking about, most of New Zealand's debt is not sovereign public debt, which has been run down to a reasonably low level, mainly due to the efforts of the previous government operating during a sort of a boom period in the first 10 years of this century. Most of New Zealand's debt is private debt, which is debt owed by New Zealand businesses, etc., and New Zealand banks. And the banks, as we know, in New Zealand are not actually New Zealand-owned banks, with one or two exceptions. They're Australian banks. And that's not really our problem. That's not a problem for you and me as taxpayers as to what Australian-owned banks owe, nor is it a problem what New Zealand businesses owe. But that public and private figure is lumped together by the Prime Minister to justify by saying, well, we have to sell off these, or partly sell off these assets, because we owe too much money. That's essentially nonsense.
What he's done is tried to blame the individual. He's tried to say it's all private sector debt.
That's right.
And that we're angels and we're not borrowing $300 million a week and right. we're not doing any of this stuff. But then,
well, exactly.
But then the problem is that the National Party won't see this.
I mean, there's a wonderful quote on a book. There was a book that I read years ago which was praising Roger Douglas and Co. for selling off the forests, which are one of the great, one of the major sort of privatisations and sales overseas of that first wave of, Rogernomics in the 80s and into the early 90s. And Douglas was quoted in this book, which was approving of him, and saying that we, him and his mates in Cabinet, we knew that the argument that to sell the forests in order to pay debt was a poor argument economically, but it was a good argument to use politically. In other words, it was a sort of a trick, a lie, to mislead people by saying, look, here we are, we're in debt, we have to sell something. So there's nothing new about that argument.
Going back to your point about the banks before, I mean, a lot of people in this country seem to think that rather than a great Jewish conspiracy, there's some great Australian conspiracy, where all the Australian banks run this country, and it's just some big kangaroo conspiracy. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely, totally asinine. If anyone looks at the backers behind ANZ Bank or anything else, they'll find Chase Manhattan, they'll find JP Morgan, they'll find all these Rockefeller Rothschild banks, essentially.
Well, I mean, I don't subscribe to some sort of conspiracy theory involving banks.
It is our problem.
The banks in this country, the four major Australian banks, effectively are in a monopoly situation once again.
It is our problem if we are indebted to XYZ foreign bank, because whatever money we have in circulation then we owe that amount plus interest. And then that amount of interest is offset as our inflation rate.
Yeah, and
it doesn't become a problem.
Yeah, and they print the money, but they don't print the interest. So technically, there's never enough money and will conceivably never be enough money to pay off the debt. It means that our country is in perpetual debt forever. Now, I don't know about you, mate, but when somebody's in debt for the rest of their natural life, it seems to me like they're going to be a perfect worker slave because, well, there's nothing else they can do. They have to work for the rest of their life to pay off all that debt, which they're never going to pay off.
The whole question of international debt was a big issue globally in the 80s and 90s, and some of the so-called third world countries took a rather startling sort of approach to it by simply refusing to pay it. I'm thinking of countries like Argentina and some of the South American countries. They just said to the international lending agencies, we'll stick it. We're not going to pay your debt back. They were contracted by governments that were undemocratically elected, etc., so that's not our problem. The problem of our people, that's your problem.
What's the difference between a foreign institution inventing a currency and issuing it, and then New Zealand and doing that in a sovereign capacity, and so it's not debt bearing. That's what I'm for. I mean, and that's what we need to be fighting here. Otherwise, we're just boxing shadows a lot of the time. Whether things public versus private becomes a false debate.
Yeah, we're moving chairs around on the Titanic.
Well, quite possibly. You're talking about the international economic system. Well, I mean, I would fully agree with you that the root cause of the problems that we're talking about is the economic system of capitalism, and the capitalism that we have at the moment is one variety of capitalism.
Yeah, there's not just one variety of capitalism. It's a lot to do with globalism, which is just, quite frankly, very, very fabulous, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we'll be right back after the break. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz, our very special Kiwi collaborator who we've been very much enjoying on the show for the duration of the last hour today is Murray Horton from CAFCA, which is the Campaign Against Foreign Ownership of Aotearoa. Murray, welcome back.
Good to be back, Vinnie.
Hey Murray, can I just add this? My theory on the government's sale of assets or any government scheme to make money somewhere from public coffers is that they are cornered by international banks into a predicament of needing to make money to pay the ever-expanding interest on the ever-expanding debt. And so that's why I'm for addressing the initial premise and saying if we had our own currency that wasn't issued out of foreign debt, and we could build some sort of real economy here, that we weren't in negative equity continuously, then the government wouldn't have so much of a premise to need to sell public assets.
Well, it's not like they have much of a premise to sell them in the first place.
They have a huge premise to sell them because our country's been indebted at a rate they cannot repay. And so,
I know what you're saying, but the premise of that happening still doesn't stack up anyway. Because selling off your public assets doesn't relieve you of any debt; it just gets you more into debt.
It does short term. Of course, it does. If I have a Ferrari in my garage here, but I'm broke and I can't pay GE money and I can't pay ASB. If I sell that Ferrari 360 for $180,000 on TradeMe, then I'm going to have some initial capital to get me through the next 6 months, and that's all they care about is getting through the next election term. Well, so, I mean, there's the incentive for them.
It doesn't
you're right,
work
that's
out
an incentive, but I mean, it's a very short-term
country,
solution,
though.
And it's not a solution in the sense that those assets, I mean...
Well, go ahead, Murray, sorry.
What I was going to say was there's this issue comes up every few years, and the point is always made by various commentators, not simply by us, that because of the amount of assets that have already been flogged off, there's less and less left to sell. It reminds me of a famous Marx Brothers film, one of the great movies, when they were sort of wanting to get somewhere in a hurry on a train, so they started burning all the carriages on the train and firing them into the sort of the locomotive furnace to make it go faster, and eventually there was no train left. And that strikes me as a very similar situation. We're going to sort of have no locomotive, no train left to get wherever it is we're supposed to be going. That selling things in order to... It's like selling your house to pay the mortgage. You might have paid the mortgage off, but then you don't have a house. So where are you going to live? What are you going to do then? Go and buy another house? And where's the money going to come from to buy the other house?
It's really putting the loco into locomotive, you know?
Exactly my analogy. Many New Zealanders are forced into mortgagee sales. They have to sell their house to pay the bank back because the bank's on their tail. And it's exactly the same if you expand that. The international banks are on the British government's tail right now. They're having to sell out. They're on the US government's tail, have been forever. They're on our tail. You know, so we're having to sell the house and all the contents and able to pay back the real house because we won't move away from dependence on them. And that's the problem for New Zealand. But people can't see it because if we start pointing to the real banks and all of a sudden we're anti-Semites or something.
Well, I don't think it's a question of that. It's purely and simply the international financial system and which large institutions dominate it, etc. But also the emphasis for the moment in this country for privatisation is coming from within the political parties, specifically the National Party, because they're presenting it as an ideological position that it is better for things to be in private ownership than it is to be in state or public ownership. It's a position that they've always held as a party, and indeed Labour adopted that position in the 80s, and they've only partly stepped back from it now, sort of 25 years later. And coming up to this election this year, they've sort of spelt out a position that is indeed a bit different from that held by National, and indeed rather different from the one that they've previously held themselves. So it's not a question of being anti-Semitic or anything like that. It's purely and simply pointing out the realities.
If you explain to people the method of fractional reserve banking, and if you start to point into Lehman Brothers and you start pointing to some of these big banks that run things. I mean, a lot of people think just America runs the world and a few corporations over there. I mean, it's ridiculous. America's has a huge amount of foreign debt. America's debt has gone up uniformly with money supply over the last 50, 60 years, totally conclusively tied. So America owes these people money. Britain owes these people money. Wait a minute, who are these people? Oh, they reside in a little place in the Westminster, in the city of London, where the Queen has to ask permission to enter. I mean, that's where they are. And if you start pointing to them, then all of a sudden people are going to come up with... I mean, I've heard it, you know, thousands of times. But how would you protect public assets? I mean, what would your strategy be?
To protect public assets, you require a political commitment from the government and the political parties that want to be the government that, in fact, they won't sell them, and if necessary, you write that into law. You make that the policy of the country in exactly the same way that New Zealand, being nuclear free, is protected by law and has become the status quo in this country. You go back, if we were having this conversation 30 years ago, it would be regarded as pie in the sky stuff if I said, let's make New Zealand nuclear free and it'll happen by law. You would say, well, no, you would need a sort of major change in public opinion, major change in political opinion, and change in the law, all that happened. And since, when is it, 1987, that has been the status quo in this country, regardless of changes of government, left-wing, right-wing, etc., etc., New Zealand is nuclear-free. So that's the way to do it. That presents the model that you simply...
We just need something that binds, regardless of who's elected, binds them to
absolutely.
Some sort of...
Well, in other words, the law. The law, and also backed up by sufficient public opinion, as the nuclear-free thing is, because it united people of both left and right, the National, Labour, all political persuasions, saying that, yes, we want New Zealand to be nuclear-free, and we will not vote for a party or government that reverses that situation. And there have been attempts to reverse the situation in the ensuing quarter century. I mean, as recently as, 2005 election, when Don Brash was the leader of the National Party, he was caught out telling an American delegation that if he was Prime Minister, the nuclear-free law would be, quote, gone by lunchtime the day after he was elected. Well, in fact, it was Brash that was gone by lunchtime, actually. So that is the way to do it. You build up a head of steam with public opinion, which makes it not worth the while of politicians of any party to proceed with selling those things off. It's the same thing that happened last year, when the national government proposed mining in the conservation estate, mining in national parks. This stirred up so many people in this country. There was a march of, 50,000 people down Queen Street in May last year. And so the government, the National Party, backed away because they saw they were buying a fight that they couldn't win. So that's the way to do it.
That's a good place to end it on. I'd like to thank you very much, Murray, for coming on the show with us today. Okay. The ruling parties of our countries are basically just the same rugby team using economic crisis, which they put the country in the position to, as a pretext to use their ideology to change our economic policy instead of facts and evidence. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, and we'll see you tomorrow.